DevOps. Auf die Ohren und ins Hirn. Ein Podcast rund um DevOps.
Von Dirk Söllner, Falco Werner und Luca Ingerni. Welcome to a new episode of DevOps auf die Ohren und ins Hirn. Or in English, DevOps from your ears straight to your brain. Usually this is a German language podcast, but we sometimes make exceptions for international guests. Today is one such exception. And in fact, it's a double exception because this is the second part of a very long interview that we started in the last episode of this podcast. Our guest is Brian Finster, who's an enterprise software engineer, very knowledgeable about SAFe, and somebody who's quite critical of SAFe just because I guess he has seen how it can go wrong and found ways to apply agility in a more effective way in the corporations he worked with and works with now. And this interview was so exciting and so long that we ended up splitting it into two episodes. So today you're going to listen to the second part of this same interview. And since we didn't actually plan on it going this long, the start is going to be a little bit jarring. I apologize for that. But we're going to essentially just jump right into the middle of it and continue where we left off roughly 2 weeks ago. Enjoy.
So if I look look on the requirements flow, requirements are at team level. So teams know what is expected. They have a product owner to talk to clarify things, not the way that you said you'll figure it out during development, but someone who really answers questions of the developers. And everything else with continuous delivery is in place and working fine. How do we get the customer in the loop? You mentioned having direct connection to the customer, giving some ideas, and a few days later you gathered feedback with an implementation for that idea. How do you get that in an organization with, I don't know, few hundred people?
Well, I think it depends on who your customer is. Mm-hmm. Right. In that situation, we are delivering to internal customers. So it'd be, you know, an hourly associate in a warehouse, just in a warehouse for Walmart. And, you know, we were trying something new and we just got them Slack accounts so that we could have conversations with them. But that was, you know, post-implementation. Before that, we had, you know, the business people we were working with as we were starting this stuff up. And it was a lot of, not just with them, but with a DBA area, operations, all these different areas. We had to go and sit down and have conversations with them and convince them that what we were going to do was better. And in some cases, we had to go bypass them because they wouldn't collaborate with us because it didn't meet what they had written down somewhere. In other cases, you know, it just took convincing and demonstration that this was actually better. Because of course, the business didn't trust us. Why should they? Every time we installed anything, it blew up. Because mm-hmm. you have quarterly releases of giant, terrible things. And so you had to go and do the legwork and the communication to build that trust up and show, hey, here's a small experiment we can run. Let's try this. Let's show you what we're capable of doing in a way that can't possibly impact you. And then just keep doing that and keep building that trust.
Okay. So internal customers. So how would you suggest to go on and extend this process, including external customers? Maybe some other organizations that use the type of product that you're developing. Maybe some, I don't know, I'm thinking global here. Maybe some countries, country organization, local organizations that are supplied with the product that you're delivering and use their feedback, or maybe even end customer type of setups where you have a support organization in between or something like that?
Well, hopefully it's not we can have a whole other podcast about support models, but it depends on the context of your application. So for example, let's say that you're delivering a platform tool. Okay. I know you guys don't know anything about that at all, but if you're delivering a platform tool, do you want to go and ask the people, how happy they are with their platform on every build? I mean, that would really annoy me. I think that NPS is something people talk about, but I got mixed emotions about that because I very rarely give feedback on anything if I'm asked. It actually annoys me. I'm just tired of being asked how I like things.
What is NPS?
Net Promoter Score.
Oh, all right.
Yep. NPS, yeah.
Yeah.
So the constant nagging for me to give feedback on stuff means that I hate you. And even if I like your product, I'll just get annoyed. I have to really like your product to give positive feedback at this point because it's just become so ubiquitous across the industry. How do you get feedback? Well, there's a couple of good ways. Are people buying more of it? Mm-hmm. And what's our defect rate? How many complaints are we getting? Because people will always complain, right? They'll always tell you that it's terrible, but they won't always tell you it's great.
Yeah.
So you can't feel good because people tell you it's great. You just really need to look at, are we able to sustainably deliver this? Are we making a profit on it? Are we growing our customer base? And not only that, are we keeping our current customers? So it's not good enough that you're gaining new customers. Or do we have loyalty from our old customers? Do they still enjoy our thing? Or do they buy it and then throw it away? Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, you need to look at the utilization metrics around that. It's similar to, when I moved to platform, we talked about how do we get feedback on the value of the tools we're building for the platform. It's like, well, are they being used? Don't ask people how much they like them. Are they being used? How many tickets are getting opened internally for problems? Just look at that. And if we have a new feature that we're trying to release, you release a small experiment on that feature and say, okay, are people actually wanting to use this feature? They want to expand on this? Or is it just completely unused cruft that we have to support forever, but we thought it was cool, so we added it?
So you're measuring the use of those tools. Are there any practices or good hints that you want to share?
I'm not a mobile developer. My work's all been on platform or an internal product. But there is feedback mechanisms available to people. You can to get those the usage metrics back.
I'm wondering though, how do you do this in maybe more challenging contexts? Like this year, I had a customer who built transformers for power stations. So like things that I imagine are as big as a house. How do you gather feedback in such an environment? How do you...
Feedback on a transformer?
Exactly. How do you iterate on your product in such an environment that is both big and safety critical?
That's a hardware problem. No.
Nice.
I mean, the transformer didn't explode. Nobody else can build it cheaper. I would probably have to come up with different things, but I haven't thought through how to get feedback on the value of the customer's perception of my transformer. I'd have to ponder that. I think not catching fire is a good one.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, it's probably not feedback on one transformer. You might also not gather feedback on just one feature and then you're done, but you're gathering feedback on a product or let's say a series of transformers with different customers and things like that. Some ideas not thought through.
Yeah, I know you're reaching far outside my domain.
Okay, fair enough. Didn't mean to put you on the spot. Yeah, but this is the thing that always pops into my head if somebody says, oh yeah, you need to go for faster feedback. And I'm thinking, well, I come from the embedded side of things. I come from the safety critical side of things. If I build my product wrong, people will die. So how do I apply this principle of fast feedback and short iterations in this context?
You need to have some sort of double of your embedded system, including having the hardware in your pipeline. If you're going to do continuously, so yeah, software to embedded systems just means that our test infrastructure looks different. And it's honestly not too much different from what I used to do, because I used to deploy straight to metal in a distribution center. I mean, sure, it's not a microcontroller, it's a Linux box, but still it's hardware. And if you wanted to run a good...
Microcontrollers these days are also Linux boxes, by the way.
Fair enough. But you still had to have hardware in your pipeline to validate that, it's just that you had to do more work around keeping things up to date on that hardware than you would if it was, a Kubernetes container. I'm doing a lot of work with the Air Force right now, and they're delivering all sorts of embedded systems with Kubernetes at this point, so... But you need to have your pipeline architecture that includes things in there to give you a high level of confidence that you can deploy. Now, can you deploy to production to a bunch of distributed, disconnected, embedded systems? No, not necessarily. The system might be off. I mean, we've had to do handheld flashes before, and we've got handhelds that are not plugged into the cradle, so you can't flash the handheld, right? But eventually you can. But the goal is to get feedback on is it releasable? It's not necessarily continuous deploy. It's is it releasable? I need to know that fast. And so, for example, I know of one company that builds satellites, and they use continuous delivery to deliver changes to their satellites all the time. And they have a satellite in their pipeline, just on the ground, that you can select, oh yeah, I need this test to run through the satellite.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you do that. You don't just kind of, throw some unit tests at it and go, wee.
Just to be frank about this, this is exactly the way I feel about this as well. Like, don't give me excuses. Don't tell me that, it's easy in software, but for us it's not possible. We can't do it, blah, blah, blah. Yes, you can. You just need to be creative. You just need to, just like you said, Brian, keep in mind the actual goal, which is to validate your product, to maintain a sufficient level of trust in your product, and how you figure that out,
I think it starts with item number one, assuming something is wrong. Something in what we've done is wrong. And we need a way to find out quickly that that's true or not, right? And to your point, it's just an engineering problem. That's all it is. There's solutions in every context. It's just an engineering problem. You're not a special snowflake.
Thank you.
In our preparations and also in the flow of the session, you mentioned Walmart and that you implemented Safe there. There was a life before and then you got rid of it, the life after. Mm-hmm. How did Safe help or block things? So maybe just give us a little bit your experience of the flow of things.
I'll say the one thing it did do is it gave everybody a common language around Scrum. Now, mm-hmm. The downside to that is that everyone thought that Scrum was agile,
mm-hmm.
and Scrum's not very agile. It's more agile than a waterfall process if you actually do it. One of the things I discovered along the way was that we're just going to kind of slide into a continuous flow and move away from sprints, because sprints become artificial roadblocks. Sprint duration, feature duration, and delivery duration, those timelines don't ever line up. So why don't we just focus on delivering features as a continuous flow of very small changes, but it did give everybody a common language to at least within the context of that organization talk about. But it also, hurt because you had yet another thing to unlearn that had been learned. Mm-hmm. And when you have been taught and had it pounded in your head that we have to manage our dependencies with process, and we have to link these teams together, and we all have to do 2-week sprints, and that a story point has to be this big, and this is how big a story has to be before you slice it, and this story's too big, and this story's too isn't you know whatever, right? They have all these process rules, and you come in and you say, okay, now we need to deliver daily, and you're going to have to change everything about how you think to get that done. It takes time to then go again, unlearn all those things. This is why I'm a much better, bigger fan of, we need to start where we want to end. We need to start with that goal in mind and talk about how to get there and not teach people an intermediate step that they then have to unlearn.
How often did you deliver or release before the safe thing in Walmart?
Oh, well, so I was there for like 19 years.
No. How often did teams?
No. It varied quite a bit. When I got there, it was very much like the company I'd come from before. We delivered when the feature was done, and that could be tomorrow. It could be in 2 weeks. It could be, you know, a big project we decided to do. And you have to understand that there was no structure around it. It's just, we need to get stuff to the business, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, as fast as possible. Then they brought in SAFe in, you know, in Agile, and then it became 2 week. Well, I'm sorry. Then they brought in project management, and we delivered at the end of the project. So that could be anywhere between a month to 6 months. In one case, we delivered after like a little over a year. You can imagine what that first install looked like.
Yeah.
For people who can't imagine, it was a complete nightmare with months of 24/7 support after that first install. So it was awesome.
What time was that? 80s, 90s?
You're talking like 2000 and 2007, 2008 time range. Then they brought in SAFe, and then you had sprints, but those weren't delivery sprints. So those were just sprints, because then you also had to have your hardening sprint, because that's a thing apparently, is a hardening sprint.
That wasn't SAFe, yeah.
And a testing sprint. So you have a testing sprint and a hardening sprint, and then you deliver. And then it was just, we're delivering quarterly. And so that just became the thing. We did improve the fact that instead of having 700 independently versioned applications, we had one version of the product that was made up of like 700 big applications. But then we were delivering that once a quarter with nightmarish support after every delivery. And then, you know, moving from that to multiple times a day on per team was awesome.
You had 700 applications that were independent, and whenever each of those applications got a new feature, you delivered that and we're done.
No. So independent would be too strong a word. We had between 700 and 800 deployables. Okay. Now, and those were nothing like services. These were either batch applications that would run on cron jobs, or they would be like full user, you know, three-tier applications, right, for different functions of the warehouse management system. But they're all coupled to a database with hundreds of tables with no delineation between business function at the database, because the database had been evolving over 20 years, and it was just a nightmare of complexity. I mean, to give you an example of that, and this isn't true anymore, but at the time, if you wanted to indicate that something was a full palette pick versus a case pick, that because database change had been so hard when they had written that functionality, because you had to go through so many hoops and open so many tickets and wait, instead of getting a new column added to indicate that, they just overloaded the last four characters of a 30 character column with PALT to indicate that it was a palette pick. And then you just had to know that that was it, because the column name had nothing to do with that. You just had to know that substring 27 through 30 of that column meant palette pick or not.
So you had very good documentation, I suppose.
Oh, excellent documentation. Yeah, all the documentation was in
Everyone had to read the code.
Yeah, you just had to read the code. Yeah. But I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, right? I mean, it's, you know, the organizational drag impacted the application so much that it was just incredibly fragile. But it was a giant monolith made up of big, you know, 700 to 800 big programs, not like microservices by any means.
Did you break that down in the time after?
That's what we were working on, right? Is we're working on strangling that out and pulling that apart into discrete business capabilities with interfaces between, with decoupled, you know, independent databases. We weren't aiming for a microservice architecture. I think that people, well, I guess it depends what you call a microservice. We were aiming for services that did one thing well. And, you know, teams owning theirs and having external interfaces between teams. But that's what we did, was we started using a reverse Conway maneuver. We built the teams around the architecture we wanted and then talked about the interfaces between those teams and gave teams the freedom to own how they implemented things as long as they met the contracts between the teams.
So you also mentioned domain-driven design. That's it, right?
Yes, that's what we started with. We started with strategic domain-driven design. We started decomposing. We drew a box on the whiteboard and set the called warehouse management system, and then started drawing boxes for each of the business capabilities. Had lots of debates about what belonged where. Came up with a disciplined approach of categorizing those things, and then drew out what the interfaces, you know, how those would interconnect with each other, and then started building teams around those capabilities. And it was very effective at coming up with you don't want to start bottom up with that. You want to have a high-level idea of what it is you're trying to build based on the knowledge you had. We already had a full-fledged system, so we had a lot of knowledge, and we had deep business expertise in the engineering teams because we've been in that domain, you know, delivering that business problem for so long.
Mm-hmm. Coming back to Walmart and SAFe implementation, you were said asking the question, why? What was the answer about the question, why SAFe? From business or whoever answered it, so someone had to answer it because he or she had decided to go that way.
Oh no, I never asked why SAFe. Once we found that life could be so much better, never looked back, and told everybody else they should abandon it as well.
Okay.
Yeah, but you know, from other people's anecdotes, why SAFe? Well, because you've got this easy thing that all you have to do is just buy this, teach everybody this one process. They all do this one process, and now we're agile.
As I feel, usually that's a decision, centralized decision somewhere.
Fairly
high management. Fairly high management in the organization who can say other organizations do that as well. And that works, and that's why we do it as well, because then we get agile.
Yeah, but you know, strangely, nobody can point me to a very successful organization, you know, high performing, able to rapidly pivot on customers' demands. No one can point me to one of those that uses Scale Agile Framework. I know Google and Amazon don't use Scale Agile Framework.
Well, maybe they should.
No, I don't think so. You know? Amazon, I was talking to Alistair Cockcroft about this a while back, and he told me that after he joined AWS, that it was the company that was best organized to scale rapidly, better than any other company, because every other team, he told me, every team at Amazon was a business unit, basically. They had, each team had their own P&L. They were fully encapsulated everything they needed. You know, they would consume platform services from other teams, right? They didn't have to own all of that. But for the business capability they were responsible for, they were fully encapsulated with everything they needed, including budget. Of course, they also had to deliver value, or the team would just get shut down. right? But you could just cookie cutter that across business capabilities, just build a team around a business capability and just scale horizontally as fast as you want.
All right. So two pizzas is still a good guideline?
Yeah. I mean, it comes back down again to communication structure. If the team gets too big, it's very difficult to communicate. And on the first pilot team that we were working, that I was working directly with on CD, we had 15 people, including the product owner on the team. And that was a lot of communication to keep up to date with. That was twice too big. If I were to do it again, if I had the option to do that, because I didn't have control over who was going to be on what team. We need a team for this. Definitely would have broken that team up into at least two teams. It's just easier to coordinate. I mean, the more moving pieces you have, the more coordination cost you incur. And so how do you make it so you don't have to coordinate so much?
Okay. Do you have a hint for breaking up such big teams into smaller ones?
Is find a business domain boundary within that team so that you don't have any weird coupling between components, mm-hmm. and then divide the team on that business domain boundary. I'd advise against trying to do a front end back end sort of thing, because then you've automatically coupled two teams together. You can deliver those individually, but it's more difficult to deliver a feature than if you had discrete feature, a full stack slice. There's trade-offs, right? There's not a right and wrong answer, but it's just better if you don't have to separate front end and back end. But finding those, again, using the intended architecture application to find that dividing line and then split the team, I'd recommend, in my experience, teams that are less than four people are not sustainable, and four is right on the boundary line. I think 5 to 8 people is a really good team size.
All right. On our preparation sheet, I see two things that I would like to mention. We talked about the dojo topic in Walmart, and I read the word safecracker. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So That's what we jokingly called ourselves in the dojo, because we couldn't come into an area and help a team do continuous delivery while they were still doing safe. And so in the process of teaching them continuous delivery, all the things that they were taught they were supposed to do under safe, we would just have to like gut and just destroy that. It just wouldn't work, right? We'd have to explain to them what we needed to change. We didn't tell them we were burning safe to the ground, but we were burning safe to the ground. Right. And we were doing it quite intentionally, because all of us had suffered under that regime in our old areas, and we wanted it to go away, because we knew that having, the approach we were taking was far more effective, both better for the teams and better for customer outcomes.
How many people objected to you burning safe to the ground?
We didn't tell them.
And they didn't realize that was what you were doing.
The leadership in that area wanted teams to deliver better. The teams wanted help in delivering better, and believed us when we said it was going to be better for the teams. And so we just said, okay, this is what we need to do. We didn't say, oh yeah, we're going to burn safety. I was like, oh no, but you just need to operate this way. Like, oh okay.
Yeah, setting a goal and giving a few hints, and at least giving freedom to get teams to find a way to the goal.
Yeah, it's amazing how much happier teams are when they're able to actually deliver things.
Yeah, if you see that you achieve something, that's always a good thing. It's motivating. That's allowing for feedback. That's allowing for improvement. It's getting really, really close to Daniel Pink's motivators, intrinsic motivation topics, mastery, purpose, and
no. And this is important, because what we discovered, we actually, a teammate and I gave a talk at DevOps Enterprise Summit in 2017 about this experience. About it's called a continuous delivery. Solving the talent problem. And the thrust of that was, number one, you already have the talent. You don't need to hire different people, or you just focus on solving a problem and the talent will solve the problem. But the other, we had a slide with like this pulsing heart on it that said it made us love development again, because it became addictive. You deliver and you get this endorphin hit every time you deliver, right? And you know, we not been doing that for so long that some people had never done that. They got hired in under this word delivering every quarter. Some of us had just forgotten how much fun it was. But if you're only delivering every quarter, every 6 months, or you know, every year, it's incredibly demotivating.
Yeah, I know organizations that deliver once a year, but do that for last, I don't know, 20, 30 years. And they have all the pain with that.
Developer experience doesn't mean pretty UIs for developers to stare at. It means that we make it easier for them to flow ideas to the end user and get feedback, that they have a joyful work experience that allows them to focus on the problem they're solving and not how the hell am I going to solve this problem with the current way that we do things.
All right. The last thing I see on our schedule is the Minimum CD org community. Is that something that spun out of your work around Walmart? Is it a part of Walmart? What is it?
No, Minimum CD was just a project that we brainstormed around the virtual bar at DevOps Enterprise Summit last year. That we'd seen all of these reports from people talking about how continuous delivery had been banned in their organization, or yes, we deliver continuously on. We deliver on demand once a month. That's not CD, right? And so we're seeing people putting out anti patterns, seeing people actually, you know, developers actually getting hurt, and we knew that if you actually did CD, that you would really see the benefits that they talk about and accelerate. They talk about continuous delivery improves delivery pain and organizational culture and all these things, that those are real if you're really doing CD, if you actually solve that problem. So we came up with this idea, what if we came up with a list of things that are true in every context, whether they're delivering a web app to the cloud or to an air-gapped environment, embedded systems, no matter what. What if we came up with a list of things that these things need to be achieved for you to be doing continuous delivery, just the minimum set of things. And we came up with a very small list of things that are true in all environments. And we were pretty brutal about cutting some things too, because people was like, oh, we should have this on the list. And it was like, yeah, that's a really good idea. Highly recommended. But it's not true in every context. And it isn't required to safely do continuous delivery. But it's a great idea. So let's put it on the list of, you know, after the minimums. But let's get people to that list of minimum things. It took us about 3 days to hammer that out. And then we started collecting signatures at the conference. So, hey, do you agree with this? Would you sign on? And we had, you know, some names from the conference who were involved with the bar discussion, you know, because we kept telling people, hey, we're talking at the bar about this. Come join, right? Just pulling in as many people. Rosalind Radcliffe was on there giving her feedback from a mainframe perspective, you know. Then after the conference, started soliciting signatures from other people in the industry. So Michael Nygaard signed on to it, and then sent it to Dave Farley. He submitted a pull request to tweak some of the language, and so he's a contributor to it. Mm-hmm. And at this point, if I pull it up, I can pull some stats for you. We're sitting at 39 contributors from across the globe. We've got translations into multiple languages. The first translation was actually Finnish, because one of the contributors, Ferrick Service, is in Finland.
I'm shocked to discover there's no German translation.
Well, it's because nobody from Germany has translated it. So you want to be...
So Luca, how about we do that?
Yeah.
I was just going to say.
We're in Spanish, French, Italian, Portuguese, and Finnish. We've got 124 people signed on to it so far. So, yeah. And that's all well and good, cool, nice hobby, bro. But I keep getting feedback from people that they are starting to use this as a roadmap to help improve things, because we literally have a section called Starting the Journey that kind of walks through some of the common struggles that people have going down this journey to give them hints and try this and try this, try this, see if this works. And we keep trying to expand some of the information out here, but it's open source community project. How do we help each other?
No, I like it. And also I like that it's delightfully blunt. There's no, you know, no hemming and hawing about it. It's like all feature work stops when the pipeline is red.
Yeah.
That's nice and straightforward and very, very shocking to many people, I think.
Yeah, no, and because those are core behaviors that are really important for the culture we want. If we can't deliver, nothing else matters. And which, you know, brings you back to what's our very first feature on any product? The pipeline to deliver the product. That's the very first feature, because it's like, I explained to somebody once that it's like adding linting to a JavaScript project when it's done. Right? The pipeline is your verification that we've done things correctly, right? And you don't want to bolt that on at the end. And every line of code that we write that we can't deliver is a risk.
You know how I got into DevOps? When I started to be a freelance, I thought I was going to be a QA professional. You know, I like testing. I'm good at it. This is fun to me. Until I realized that I couldn't actually be a QA person successfully without taking control of the entire value stream from end to end.
Yeah.
And that is how I accidentally ended up in DevOps.
You know how I learned how to test? Because, you know, I'd spent years working in a language that I'm not even aware a testing framework exists for it, right? The way I learned how to test was, hey, we're going to need to do this continuous delivery thing. I'm like, oh, hang on. That means that I've got to push code every single day to production. We're manually testing. We can't ship untested code. So we have to, and this was not just me, this was like the entire area, right? We have to learn how to test. and then you start adding rules to it because of continuous delivery. Well, our test architecture has to meet the requirements of no human touch after commit. So we have to architect all of the, all of the verification with that mindset that I can't hand it off to somebody else, can't happen afterwards. The pipeline has to verify every line of code. So that means all of the tests have to be written and versioned with this commit, right? And so it starts changing your mindset about how you architect tests. And a lot of people struggle with that. And they're like, well, no, this is how you test. Well, no, that's how you test. But that's not how you test for continuous delivery.
Wonderful. I don't think we can get any better than this for a nice ending for this recording, can we?
That's for you to say.
No, but this I think has been an awesome episode. I think I learned a lot, and we are running way over time anyway.
Yeah, I'm happy with it as well. So, very great job you did, Brian. Thanks for all the ideas and things you shared. Not making it a rant only, but also good, positive ideas and experiences.
Yeah, and you know, just FYI, I'm feeling a little under the weather today, so I'm a little spacey. So. So some of my answers might be a little, I think that's one of the things that, you know, we were really trying to pull off, by the way, you're talking about how just direct it is that this is an engineering discipline. Mm-hmm. This isn't hand wavy, agile-y, coachy, whatever, right? This is an engineering discipline. And so we can just be, there's some things that are, should always be true, and other things that it depends, but this is what it is. And as engineers, we shouldn't have to sugarcoat it.
This is something that I always find interesting about those agile conversations. Just like you said, Brian, that this is just good, solid engineering craft. Mm-hmm. When I was at university, I've got a degree in mechanical engineering, and my professors would bang on about what is called in German, Ingenieurmäßiges Vorgehen, an engineer's approach, or the engineer's approach. And that was just be iterative. Think of something, form a hypothesis, find a way of falsifying it, and then move on depending on what you observe.
Yeah.
So by no means software specific. This is by no means new. Like, I can guarantee you, I wasn't there, but I can guarantee you that the wheel wasn't invented in a waterfall process.
You mean they didn't have a final idea for a wheel before they started? No, I agree. I think that there's so many people out there who just think that this is an art form, and say it's not engineering. Well, engineering includes art. The Chrysler Building required engineering, but it's also art. But it's well engineered. It's not just kind of random throw shit together and see if it works, right? And this whole idea that this is just something that we just kind of do, and it's no. We need some discipline and rigor around this if we're going to do this well, and we owe that to ourselves because it's a better way of working. This is not a hobby. If you want to do hobby coding, do that at home.
Yeah,
agreed.
Fine. So it sounds like we've got the final word after the final word.
Oh, that was my post-recording rant.
It's still recording, though. Okay. All right. So in that case, let's just wrap this one up.
I was going to say, so Falco, how hard did Amadeus rock you?
I don't know. I was rock as a baby. I was rock very good, and I really like Amadeus. I also love the dead Austrian singer you're referencing.
there's one other thing to add, which is there's a parody site that you might enjoy. Scaled Agile DevOps Maturity Framework.
Yeah, we'll be sure to put that into the show notes.
Yeah, I'm not the that was an idea that came out of the Dojo Consortium. I didn't invent. Well, I'll say that the title came out of the Dojo Consortium, but that's been a labor of love over the last 18 months or so.
It's beautiful. It is absolutely beautiful. All right, so Brian, thank you so much. This was a very enlightening conversation, and I hope we can have another one another day when you're better rested.
Yeah. I'm sorry I'm a little lightheaded today, but no, thanks for having me. It was fun.
Okay, so goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Bye.